This is not the happiness you want. I throw the mop onto the floor. The clattering makes Jen flinch. I can't have the happiness that I want. On top of everything else, why should I have to carry around that weight, too? What I feel for Thomas is the loudest thing I've ever had ringing through me. I can be me again, or some form of me when that ringing shuts up. Thomas steps toward me. I'm trying to make sense of this, Stretch. This guy, Colin, the one we saw at Comic Book Asylum and at the track field, you forgot him, but still knew him? I forgot my time with him, I say. Thomas looks me in the eyes, and I turn away. What does that mean for me? Do we have enough history that you would still recognize me? Would you forget me? Maybe, I say, wishing I were somewhere else, even back home with Eric. I don't know exactly how Lateo puts together their blueprints. Thomas sniffs. I look up. His eyes are red and watery. I haven't seen him cry since Brendan laid into him. Remember back in June when we left that Lateo rally? You agreed with me that everyone serves a purpose. Is our friendship really so worthless now? He asks. When I don't answer, he turns to Genevieve. I'm going. It doesn't sound like an invitation, but she looks at me one more time before following him anyway. Genevieve is right. I don't want this happiness. But blind happiness is better than inhabitable unhappiness. After my shift, I go straight to my building, ignoring baby Freddy's shouts to hang out. I enter the lobby just as my mom exits the downstairs laundromat, pushing the heavy load of clothes in a shopping cart. I come up beside her and take over, heading to the elevator. Genevieve and Thomas stopped by, I say, keeping my cool. She doesn't even try and play it off or explain herself. Thomas, too? I press the elevator button. Yeah. Did you only recruit Jen for the mission? Outside your family, she loves you the most, Mom says. I thought that was my best shot. Maybe so, but I guess Jen thought bringing along the guy I want to be my happiness might be a better bet. That girl is really something else. I'm tired of this fight, Aaron. I know it's my responsibility as a parent to give you the life you want, especially since I failed at getting you your own room and finding you a father who didn't get so lost in his own head. But I don't want to lose my son. The elevator arrives, but we don't get on. I just don't think I'm that different from him. You are, my son. You are. You are kind and too good for the bad you've lived through. If you're sure, if you promise me that in this moment you'll forgive me for signing off on your procedure, I'll do it. I hug her, promising over and over that this is what I want, what I need, that there would never be any reason to forgive her. Hold on, she says. Here we go. I'll sign off on one condition. I want you to visit Kyle and his family on Saturday. I get to see Kyle. That's more than enough. Chapter 9. Kyle Lake, the only child. When Kyle and Kenneth were younger, twins, still so identical, even I couldn't tell them apart, they made up this game called Happy Hour. They didn't know what Happy Hour meant in the real world, but they heard it enough from grown-ups. They would come home from school and shout, Happy Hour! Whenever their parents asked them to settle down and do their homework. They'd be granted 1 hour of play time, relax time, whatever, before having to do work and chores. Happy Hour changed as they got older, transforming into a therapeutic, judgment-free hour of bitching. I don't even know who Kyle bitches to now. It required a lot of back and forth, but my mom teamed up with Evangeline to make this meeting happen. Mom had to sign a permissions request and a confidentiality form, and some other papers promising never to disclose the location of the lakes to anyone except me. I'm not sure what the penalties are, but I guess it would just be really shitty of her to send the block flooding to 174th Street right off the Simpson Avenue train stop. I guess their housing budget post-procedure wasn't very high, otherwise they would have escaped to the deep end of Queens, not 30 blocks and several avenues over from where they started. When I get to their apartment building, right beside a video rental store with a closing sign, I feel shaky. I press the intercom. "Who is it?" Mrs. Lake asks. "Aaron," I say. They buzz me in without a word. I walk straight to apartment 1E and knock twice. Both Mrs. and Mr. Lake, their first names lost on me, look taken aback when they open the door. It's the wounds on my face, no doubt. I'm surprised at how happy I am to see them, considering how little time I've wondered about them. But now I remember the sleepovers where Mrs. Lake would play video games with us, and I remember the times Mr. Lake would accompany us on school trips to the Bronx Zoo, always sneaking us candy. I hug them both at once. They welcome me inside. It hurts to see an apartment so different from the one I saw my friends grow up in. The walls are beige, not rust orange. The windows have bars like a prison cell. The TV in the living room is gigantic. Not the flat screen Mr. Lake won from a sweepstakes last year. The game consoles are all still here, but all of Kenneth's trivia and soccer games aren't. The cat-shaped clock Kyle gave Kenneth for the 10th birthday isn't hanging in the living room like it was in the last apartment. It really is like Kenneth never existed. "You want some iced tea?" Mr. Lake offers. "Just water, please." Iced tea brings back another memory of Saturday mornings over at the old Lake apartment. We had cereal in bowls of iced tea because we all don't like milk. She brings me the water, and they sit across from me. "How are you both doing?" I ask.
"Do you want the truth?" Mr. Lake replies.
I nod, knowing I'm about to regret it.
"Hurts every day," Mrs. Lake chimes in.
"There's no forgetting. You see Kyle, and you expect Big Brother Kenneth to be tailing after him. There are still mornings where I almost ask Kyle to wake his brother up. It doesn't matter that it's been 10 months, or that we're in a new home. I can never believe I lost one of my boys." Mr. Lake stays quiet. He used to make jokes about how Kyle isn't actually his own person, just an alternate universe version of Kenneth gone wrong. "I miss when Kenneth would get ragey whenever someone called him Kenny," I say. As soon as the words come out, I wish I could take it back. It's not like I was invited to share a story, but I can't stop. All at once, I'm spilling out more and more things about Kenneth, like when he faked his eye exam in order to get glasses so people could tell him and Kyle apart, and when they dressed up as stormtroopers for Halloween, and that time we were with Brendan in the band room while he rolled up a blunt, and Kenneth discovered he could play clarinet, which I hope to God still exists somewhere in this fake home and isn't in the hands of some stranger. The Lakes are crying by the time I have to take a breath.
"I'm sorry,"
I say.
"Don't be, Aaron."
"Thank you," Mr. Lake says, staring into my glass of water he's still holding.
"We never get to talk about our son anymore. It's energizing to hear someone remember him so fondly. Makes me feel less crazy, like I didn't just make up this second son."
"How do you do it? How do you not find yourself banging down Lateo's doors to give you the same procedure Kyle got?"
"We couldn't dishonor his existence like that," Mrs. Lake says. "Parents have done it, and it breaks my heart tenfold. You move on. You have to. But you don't write someone out.
Mr. Lake looks at the timer on the microwave.
Kyle should be getting home soon, Clara. We should fill Aaron in on everything.
They tell me the story of why Kyle thinks they moved. He had a history of fights with me crazy. No love lost for that psycho when the Lakers moved away. Starting from slaps to the back of the head on the school bus to being pushed into lockers and eventually straight-up fistfights. Whoever served as the architect for Kyle's blueprint, not Evangeline, I learned, tapped into very real emotions to create a very believable narrative that would never send Kyle back to our block. He just accepts his new life as a barber's apprentice, and boyfriend to some girl Mrs. Lake hopes is around forever. The intercom buzzes.
Always forgetting his keys, Mrs. Lake says. Why don't you go wait in his room? We'll send him in to you.
I head to his room, and Mr. Lake issues out one more obvious and painful reminder.
Aaron? No Kenneth.
I nod, even though he can't see me. If there's one thing that hasn't changed, it's the smell of weak old socks and underwear. Kenneth wasn't exactly a laundry fan either, the two of them putting it off until Mrs. Lake gave in and did it herself. But everything else is different. Like the queen-sized bed Kyle now has, bunk beds gone, and the memorabilia from times I wasn't around for. The door opens. Kyle, an oblivious, only child, walks into his room and laughs at me.
Your face is busted, Aaron!
There's no hug, or fist bump, or how-have-you-been moment. We just are. Like we were never separated at all.
Me crazy got me too, I say, careful with my words.
I'm crossing a field of minds. I want to tell Kyle that me crazy is in jail, but maybe he'll think the block is safe for visits. God knows what would happen if someone, just to be a dick, straight up told him he went through Lateo and unstitched his shielded memories. I see why you bounced. Kyle leans against his wall, a map thumbtacked to the space above him.
I couldn't keep risking it. Good thing our lease was up anyway, so we could get a fresh start. Shittier neighborhood, but some good people here.
I hear you got a girlfriend, I say, picking up a handball from his bedside drawer. I toss it to him.
Who locked you down?
We play catch, as he tells me about Tina, a Chinese-American girl he met when she brought her little brother into the barbershop. Kyle was giving a Caesar cut and almost messed up. His mentor thought he was distracted because of the work, but it was all because of Tina. I try to pretend I'm interested, but find myself almost tuning out until he asks,
"How's Genevieve?"
We broke up. I remember what Thomas told me when he broke up with Sarah. We just weren't really right for each other anymore.
Damn, man.
Any new prospects yet?
Nope. I lie.
I want to come out to Kyle, but he'll have no idea what I'm talking about if I ask him to set the clock for a judgment-free happy hour.
He's changed. Not matured, but he's been changed, obviously. Maybe this new Kyle will be cool with Side A. Maybe it'll make him uncomfortable. I used to know the person in front of me, and I'm tempted to bring him back, to unwind him, since Kenneth's death is his fault, and he should have to live with that. He should know about how Kenneth could walk on his hands, how Kenneth always ate junk food and never had a single cavity, how Kenneth casually played ding-dong ditch on his neighbors to get a rise out of us. He should know Kenneth, his twin brother, existed. But it's not my decision to make. I hang around for a little while longer, until it's time for him to shower and meet up with Tina. He puts his girl first now, which I like. I promise to visit him again sometime soon, and he tells me to tell everyone on the block he says what's up. I hug Mrs. and Mr. Lake again.
whose faces silently plead. Don't forget.
Chapter 10 Lateo, Take 2 It's the day of my procedure, and I'm standing on the corner outside the Lateo Institute. Memories. Some can be sucker-punching. Others carry you forward. Some stay with you forever. Others you forget on your own. You can't really know which ones you'll survive if you don't stay on the battlefield, bad times shooting at you like bullets. But if you're lucky, you'll have plenty of good times to shield you. Being gay wasn't, and isn't, the problem. It only seemed that way because of everything that branched out from it. My father taking his life, Colin abandoning me, getting jumped on the train, and all the uncertainties ahead. The problem was that I didn't know any better because I forgot my life. And now, I know I can't forget. It won't be an easy life, but I'll soldier through. Thomas didn't even know he was helping me with this. Hell, I didn't even know I would become myself again, in need of this guidance. The boy with no direction taught me something unforgettable. Happiness comes again, if you let it. I close my eyes and count to 60, zoning everything out like Thomas taught me to do. I reopen my eyes, turn my back on Lateo, and walk home. I owe my mom and brother an apology. Chapter 11 My Unhappy Birthday. Ever since my first birthday, my mom has written me a letter recording my greatest hits of each year. She leaves the letters in my baby album. She even attaches newspaper clippings so I know what was current. I caught up on all of them on my 12th birthday. I wasn't surprised that the first letter was pretty uneventful, aside from me spitting up on my mother's graduation gown as she accepted her diploma. Before my second birthday, I walked for the first time when my father came home after being gone for a week, which I learned later was because he got kicked out after assaulting my mom in the street. In the fifth letter, I learned I was once obsessed with collecting keychains. A drawing, paperclipped to the eighth letter, showed me holding my mom's hand. These letters are a map of my life. They bring into focus years that are hazy to me. It hurts to admit it, but there were things in those letters that feel like Mom was taking a shot at me. Why did she write down that I was obsessed with singing songs from girl pop stars? Or how when she took Eric and me shopping for toys at CVS, I didn't let him bully me into buying a blue Power Ranger because I wanted to play with a Jean Grey action figure? I feel like it was her coded way of saying, "This is when I knew about you." I think liking Brendan was the first time I knew. Sure, singing girl songs was a tip-off too, I guess. But that's when it all clicked that maybe I wasn't who everyone would like me to be. It's funny the way that ran full circle. A couple years ago, I threw away old magazines my mother left sitting in the bathroom, but not before I ripped out pages of hot cologne models and stashed all of them inside an old binder for whenever I had urges. But I got rid of all that before the procedure. I haven't gotten around to apologizing to Eric or my mom yet, but I will. They were relieved enough the other night when I said I didn't want the procedure anymore. A cloud over our tiny home had lifted. I went straight to bed. So now I'm acting like this Lateo episode never happened. Eric has agreed to play Avengers versus Street Fighters with me. When Mom gave me the game this morning, I didn't comment on the scratches on the disc. I don't deserve a mom who works too many hours a week so she can afford our outrageous rent, keep food on the table, and even make sure she has something to give her boys on their birthdays. I lose to Eric because I chose Captain America instead of Black Widow,
not trying to draw attention to my growing desire to tell him side A and be done with it. Before I leave, I go into Mom's room to thank her again. There are some bills fanned out next to her, and on her lap is my baby album. We have a birthday ritual where we look through it together, but maybe she realized the last thing I want to do is reflect on the old days. I see a photo of myself as a 5-year-old holding a figurine of Belle from Beauty and the Beast. First love, right? Mom strokes the picture as if she can twirl my old curls. You carried her everywhere. I remember telling everyone she was my girlfriend. I remember believing it, too. Until you broke up with her for the Pink Power Ranger, Mom half smiles. Tale as old as time. She flips through the album, and this reel of my life is lost to me. There are pictures of me on my father's shoulders when he was still Dad. One of me taking a bath with Eric when we were kids. Another one where I'm wrapped in a towel, lying across his lap. Another, and in all these photos is something hard to find now. Smiles. I'm going to go run out for a bit. She looks up at my face, and I know she's studying my bruises, yellowed, but almost healed. Sometimes I look out the window to try and catch Brendan chilling, thinking maybe I can run downstairs and snuff him. I'll be fine. How's Genevieve? Happy, I lie. And it's a lie because you can't be happy with someone who can't love you back.
Are you meeting up with her today?
Nope, I say. She hasn't even called or texted me. Going to go see Thomas? That one stabs me hard. I haven't heard from him either. I'm linking up with Colin. She holds my hand and nods.
Okay, my son. Go have fun. Be safe.
She dismisses me, but doesn't release her grip on me. Not for a while. And when she does, she holds on to the baby book the way someone would hold on to the edge of a cliff. Feet dangling. I think Colin has legit forgotten it's my birthday. But maybe it's because he's been really stressed lately. Nicole is demanding more attention from him since he's been spending his free time with me behind her back. His other complaints are small, like how she's craving ice cubes. The crunching bothers him. Screw all his bitching because it's his fault she's pregnant. Okay, our fault for being cowards, but he's 100% to blame for letting her fall in love with him. I never really understood why he liked Nicole. And you can argue that I'm looking at her with the wrong lenses, but I know she's the type of thoughtful girl who will wish you happy birthday every hour of the day and get you presents you never realized you wanted. I can't pretend Colin is the only guilty one. I'm not an asshole, too. I let Genevieve fall in love with me. But that means Thomas is also an asshole because he let me fall. Yeah, he definitely let me fall and couldn't bother to pick me up. But I have Colin. I never admitted loving him to his face, not even to fill these holes of loneliness. When he tells me to follow him, I'm expecting a surprise. But instead we end up at our spot behind the fence. We have sex quickly, and he heads off to work without wishing me a happy birthday, just a pat on the back after he pulled up his pants from around his ankles. I go the long route so I can walk past Thomas's building in the hopes of seeing him outside or staring out of his window. Yeah, there's the risk of seeing him holding hands with Genevieve as they go upstairs and probably have sex so he can feel straight. But I've been through that pain before with Colin, and I just want to see him for at least a moment. I spot Skinny Dave across the street, and when he sees me, he stays underneath the traffic light even though it's signaling for him to cross. He knows better now that me crazy isn't around.
Maintenance has finally boarded the lobby door with plywood. I check the mail. There are 2 birthday cards from my 80-year-old aunt with dementia. I'm not as surprised that she sent 2 cards as I am that she remembered my birthday at all. I walk down to the elevator and, just like he surprised me the day me crazy almost killed me, Thomas is there. He's leaning against the wall, and I want to smile, but I don't because he isn't. I didn't get the procedure, I tell him. He looks at me for a second. The circles under his eyes are darker than when I saw him at Good Foods. He opens the staircase door and rolls out a dark blue mountain bike. It's either a new bike or something he waxed and fixed up until it looked new. I'm not sure which it is because he's capable of both. He presses down on the kickstand and walks over to me. I'm scared he's going to walk past without saying anything, but instead, he hugs me hard. And I hug him back, also hard, because there's something that feels very final about this hug. When he lets go, I do too, which feels insanely stupid. Then he starts walking toward the door. Thomas, I fell. Not once does he stop. Or even hesitate. He walks straight out and leaves me. And now I'm alone with a bike he once promised to teach me how to ride, since no one else ever did. Both of us unaware at that time that it was a lie. Colin tried, and I sucked. I eventually find the strength to go upstairs, gripping the handles of my shiny new blue bike tightly. I collapse onto my bed with the bike at my feet. Seeing him was what I wanted, no, needed, for this day to even feel somewhat right. But now I'm just staring at the clock as the hours run by, wondering if I'll hear from Genevieve before it hits midnight. And then the weirdest shit happens. It's already 1:16 a.m. Eric is sleeping. There's a dinner plate at the foot of my bed where I always leave it, except I don't remember eating whatever it was, or even being hungry. On my phone, there's a message from Genevieve wishing me a happy birthday at 11:59 p.m. I should respond to her and say thank you, but she's probably asleep too. The last thing I remember is throwing myself on my bed. Nothing after that. Total blackout. I'm so scared. I'm crying. Except I don't really know if I can pinpoint the moment when I started crying. I turn to the clock that's jumped from 1:16 to 1:27, and I cry harder because something impossible is happening to me. I shake Eric awake, and he curses at me before his face registers something is off. I don't even know what to tell him at first, still not convinced that this isn't a nightmare. But finally I say, "What the fuck? What the fuck is going on?" He asks me what I'm talking about, but the words sound far away. I'm suddenly disoriented again. I find myself in the middle of my mom's bed, crying so hard my throat aches. As a kid, I would pray at the edge of the bed for new action figures or my own bedroom. Then I would crawl into the space left open for me between my brother and mom because I couldn't sleep without holding her hair. But as my mind continues steering itself, going this way and that, I find myself praying only to wake up. Chapter 12. No More Tomorrows. Anterograde amnesia, Evangeline tells my mother and me. We're in her office. It's 4:09 a.m. I've been keeping my eyes pinned to the clock for my own sanity, though I can't really tell if there has been any other crazy skip in time like a few hours ago. It's an inability to form new memories, she adds. The clock reads 4:13 a.m. What's anterograde amnesia? I ask. It sounds familiar,
I think she mentioned it before my procedure, but I can't remember what it is.
It's an inability to form new memories, Evangeline replies, exchanging looks with my mother, who's crying.
She's pretty much been crying since I ran into her bed. When she called Evangeline, she was crying. On the cab ride over, she was crying. I can't remember her not crying.
Are you following, Aaron? Evangeline asks.
Yeah, I say. You think that's what's happening to me? That I'm not remembering stuff that's going on now?
Can you recall any other issues with your memories recently? She presses.
You're asking me to remember something I probably forgot?
Yes. Something that may have confused you since your attack, but stuck out to you, like earlier tonight.
Thinking is hard. No. Remembering is hard. I'm proud of myself when I remember how odd it felt when I couldn't remember drinking my first cup of coffee at the diner with Colin, and how Genevieve told me I was repeating myself at Lateo. I only told her Thomas didn't like her once. Or I thought I only said it once. And when I blanked out at Good Foods. Who knows what else?
Yes, I answer, my heart pounding. I can remember forgetting stuff.
I just can't remember what I'm forgetting.
I feel like I should be crying or having a panic attack.
My mother buries her face in her hands, racked with silent sobs. Evangeline takes a deep breath before telling me,
"You already did."
What does this mean? How do you fix me? Another procedure?
She sounds like a robot when she speaks. There are a bunch of options, though nothing sounds promising. The condition is still a mystery, even to top neurologists, because no one's locked down the exact science of storing memories. She says something about neurons and synapses and medial temporal lobes and the hippocampus, and even though it's all doctor speak, I do my best committing it to memory because I can already feel the words slipping away. The treatments used for those suffering from anterograde amnesia aren't all that different from the ones used for Alzheimer's patients. Medication can enhance the cholinergic brain functions. Psychotherapy is not necessary. This is about brain function. Probably for the best, because I would punch someone if they tried using hypnosis on me. The last thing I need is someone else playing with my mind.
What I want to forget is when she says, "Unfortunately, in some cases it's irreversible." I can't help but notice she sounds tired. And not because it's in the middle of the night, or because she's bored, but possibly because she's exhausted of repeating herself in the event she's told me this several times already.
"Has this happened to any of your patients before?"
Evangeline nods.
"Yes."
"So? What happened?" She meets my gaze.
"The amnesia takes hold quickly, sometimes within a few days."
"So I have less than a fucking week?"
No one scolds me for my language.
"Maybe more," Evangeline says in that clinical and robotic tone. My heart pounds harder. And I'm scared I'm forgetting how to breathe, a basic instinct. I feel like I'll faint, and then I'll probably forget how to wake up.
What the hell will my life look like?
"Challenging, but not impossible. This was all in the literature, Aaron. For the most part, you might be limited to the knowledge you had before the procedure. I know of a musician who writes his own songs and forgets them soon after, but he still plays guitar beautifully because it's a skill he learned before the trauma he wished to erase."
I understand what she's saying.
"Before."
"Before is all I will have left. And before destroyed me before."
"Why bother living?"
I'm thinking out loud, and my mom cries harder.
Shitty of me because the smiling scar on my wrist speaks for itself. But right now, like before, dying seems easiest. Evangeline leans toward me.
You have so much to live for, she whispers.
Like what? I ask.
And either she told me, and I already forgot, or she has nothing convincing to say.
This is going to be a long night.
Well,
a long night for them, anyway.
It'll fly by for me.
What's anterograde amnesia? I ask Evangeline at 4:21 a.m. Chapter 13. Only Yesterdays. I sort of, kind of, definitely always took yesterdays for granted. And now yesterdays are all I have left. Some of them, at least. Yesterday. A lot of people will remember a hug with a friend, but will have forgotten what time they woke up and ate for lunch. Others will share the crazy dreams they had last night, but the clothes they wore or books they read on the subway will slip away. And some will keep their stories to themselves, a secret left in the past only they can revisit. I will do none of those things. Tomorrow I might not remember hugging anyone, if there's anyone even left to hug. I won't know what I ate for lunch, and will only know if I ate at all, depending on whether or not my stomach is growling. What time I wake up won't matter, because I'll always be waking up. And I'll probably wear the same shirt and pants over and over while endlessly recommending Scorpius Hawthorne because new words will have zero weight in my head. The only way I can see myself getting through this is by saying goodbye. Even if I never change, everything and everyone around me will. No one's going to hang with a guy who doesn't know what day it is or can't keep up with their lives. I'll always be lost and lonely, or surrounded by strangers constantly repeating themselves. Lose, lose. When I try the door, the chain is on. We never used to use it. We weren't even using it in case any of my friends tried breaking in to finish the job me crazy started. This can only mean that they're locking me in, so I don't get lost outside. I feel sick, but they're right. I could forget where I am in the middle of the street, or even in the middle of the air after a car sends me flying. On the other hand, I can't just wait here while my mind withers away. I quickly unchain the door, but Eric is fast and catches me before I can run out. "What the hell are you doing?" he demands, holding my arm tight. "I have shit to do." Mom appears from her room, but stays silent.
"What's that?" Eric asks.
"Something I need to do for myself."
That's not a surprise.
He stops himself and takes a deep breath.
"I'm going to shut up and be a good brother and not talk to you until I'm sure you won't remember." Low blow.
"Fuck you. Say it now and don't hide behind my amnesia. You owe me that."
"Okay, I'm game," Eric says,
his grip on my arm tightening, his eyes ablaze.
"You're selfish, Aaron. You used a cheat code to make life easier without thinking about how it would affect us. We've had to watch you walk around like a zombie. You did this to yourself, okay?"
I stare back at him.
"Maybe I wouldn't have raced to forget myself if you made me feel more comfortable with who I am instead of giving me shit for choosing girl characters in video games."
"I never gave a flying fuck about any of that. They were just jokes. I thought you were tough enough to handle them. I'm sorry."
His words, his apology, take us all back, himself included. The last time I saw him this red was when we told him what happened to our father. So it's no surprise, he adds, "You stopped being your own man to please someone who abandoned us.
He committed suicide because of me, not you.
Baby, he didn't kill himself because of you,
Mom finally jumps in. Your father had it rough and—
Stop it!
When he was arrested, I thought we were finally safe from him. And then he came home and—
I'm crying, but I'm happy that I can remember when the tears started falling. It was when I admitted his absence was a good thing.
That shuts them up. Shuts me up, too, because I now understand why they threw away all his stuff. They always knew better.
You messed up, Eric says.
But his voice softens, and there's something different in his eyes. It's sympathy. He turns to Mom, rapping his knuckles against the wall with his free hand, his other hand still gripping me. Our father rapped his knuckles against the wall like that once, when he was pissed we wouldn't go downstairs to get him a slice of pizza from Yolanda's. Then he punched a hole in it. I feel something like hope, just because of the fact I remembered.
You should have never signed off on that procedure, he says to Mom.
Mom looks back and forth between us, like she's just been outed for a crime.
I was trying to save your brother.
No, Eric snaps. This is about you and losing control of your family. You treated Aaron like he would have been helpless without this procedure, and look where that's landed him.
I wrench myself free of Eric's grasp.
Maybe he is cracked. Maybe he had some things he wanted to forget, too. Maybe he wasn't quite right in the head either after our father committed suicide in the same bathtub where he bathed us. In this moment, I know Eric is not going to grow up to be like our father. He loves us. He should have been paid the same attention from not only our mom, but from me, too. I never asked him how he was doing. Mom catches herself in the grimy hallway mirror. Maybe she's really seeing herself now. She's lost so much weight these past few months, maybe 20 or 30 pounds. Eric leans back against the wall and slides down.
This isn't about me being jealous of you, Aaron. Maybe I am a little bit. But I agree that we're better off without him.
I'm tempted to reach down and take his hand, but I don't. He looks up at me.
Remember when we had trouble beating the last few levels of Zelda? We pulled our allowances and bought the walkthrough guide to help us out.
He softly adds,
"You should have asked for help before cheating."
Sometimes pain is so unmanageable that the idea of spending another day with it seems impossible. Other times, pain acts as a compass to help you get through the messier tunnels of growing up. But the pain can only help you find happiness if you can remember it.
Do we still have anything that belonged to Dad? I ask.
And then the box is in my hand. It's not even half full, just a couple of old sweaters and track sneakers. Eric opens the door for me without a fight, and he and Mom both follow me to the garbage chute down the hall. I cling to every detail. This will make for a memory. And despite everything, I can't help but hesitate when I think back to the days where my father wasn't a monster. Then, I turn the box over, and everything thumps down the chute until it's quiet. In school, I once read about gypsies and how they grieved for loved ones by covering all the mirrors in their caravan for as long as they needed. Sometimes days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months, and in rare cases, years. As of now, we're done covering the mirrors. Together we've searched the apartment for any last scrap of him we don't want. Eric puts on his sneakers after we get back inside the apartment. Without looking at me, he says, "If it's worth anything to you, I'm sorry for everything I ever said." I want to thank him for swallowing his pride. But he quickly adds, "So where are we going?"
"What?
You said you have shit to do, right? Mom's not going to let you go alone."
"I don't remember saying that. But I do have shit to do.
I have 4 people to see. 4 goodbyes to make. I keep my head low and let my brother follow me out so I can strike names off this bucket list of mine."
Chapter 14. The Sort of Best Friend. It's a dead giveaway where we can find Brendan. We spot his client go into the staircase. I want to see Brendan first, not because he lives closest to me, not because I've known him the longest, but because he needs to see the damage he's done. I'm about to go into the staircase when Eric stops me. "I shouldn't have let you have sex with Genevieve," he whispers. I'm so confused that I almost laugh.
"That had nothing to do with you."
"I knew the truth. That's enough to put me at fault if you got her pregnant. I didn't stop you because I thought your life was going to be easier when you weren't gay. It didn't matter to me if you unknowingly led someone on." And then Eric is pacing from wall to wall in the lobby. "That had nothing to do with you," I say, and immediately after I say it, I can't get aboard the train of thought that brought me to those words. "I don't know what's going on."
"It's okay," Eric says. He recaps the conversation.
"It's crazy how you still turned out to be gay. You must really like that dude you kept hanging out with."
Now this is so awkward, I actually do want to forget it.
"I have to go take care of this," I mumble. "Wait here for me."
I hand him the comics I want to give Colin, and run into the staircase before he can protest. I don't hear Brendan or that girl Nate running off, so I keep jogging down. Brendan looks like he's seeing a pissed-off ghost when I turn the corner. I swing at him, and he ducks, which is fine because I was really hoping to kick him in the balls. Which I do. He crumples to the floor. Nate picks up the weed and runs away. No doubt she lost a dealer after stealing, but she won't give a shit while she's high today. Brendan holds his crotch, his manhood, and groans.
"I had that coming."
I almost have sympathy pains for him, because getting a hit in the balls sucks hard. Almost.
"You fuckers fucked up my fucking brain!" I shout, ready to pounce on him all over again. "Major fucking memory loss, and there's a chance I'm going to fucking forget this fucking conversation, but I'll never fucking forget how my fucking friend almost fucking killed me because he fucking hated me!"
No matter how many times I say it out loud, or to myself, I can never wrap my head around the fact that Brendan could have gone to jail forever for killing me.
"Maybe it's okay to forget."
I'll never play cards in his hallway again whenever it's snowing outside, or too chaotic to hang out in his house. I'll never throw popcorn at his grandfather while he's snoring in front of the TV again. I'll never sleep over again and kick at the top bunk where he almost got this girl Simone pregnant before he learned the magic of condoms. I'll never sit at his computer with him and write crude customer reviews on insane products, like a banana slicer and dog-shaped dog whistles. I'll never leave his sneakers outside the window so his room won't smell like feet.
"I don't hate you," Brendan says. "I just don't understand why you're being gay."
"I can't change that," I say. Except for that time I could. And even then, I still kind of couldn't. He sits up and rests his elbow on his knee.
"You chose that Thomas kid over us. We're your blood, not him or anyone else."
"Maybe that's true. But I never knew. And I'm basically a toy without batteries because of you guys."
"Your boys will take care of you, eh?"
even if I'm gay?
I say the word out loud, about myself, because even though I never chose this, I can choose to accept it before it's too late. Brendan says nothing. I have my answer. I head back up the stairs and hope one day Brendan will find his happy ending. I really do want this for my very confused, former, sort of best friend. Chapter 15. The Boy Who Won't Man Up. I'm about to sit in the alleyway between the meat market and flower shop and maybe flip through one of the comics I brought for Colin. Issue number 7 of The Dark Alternates, the big finale. But community service do-gooders are painting over the spray-painted black and blue world Colin and I made. And then he's here. "Sup," Colin says, nodding at me. He looks around, probably for spies with cameras, and finds the community service team in our spot.
"Hey, what the hell are they doing?"
"Community service," I say.
"Where can we go instead? You need to go buy a condom, too, because Nicole was finally in the mood last night and I used mine."
Of course he uses a condom after she's pregnant.
"Don't need them."
"You want to do it without?
Look. Our graffiti is gone."
"Yeah, that sucks."
"Oh, shit! You got the last issue! Let's go read it!"
I hand the comic over to him. In another life, this could have been cool. He speculates on what might happen.
"Who do you think the redhead in the scarlet robe is? Do you think the faceless overlords will go through with the siege?"
"Shit!
They have to, don't they?"
"Man, this is going to be insane!"
I sit down on the curb and ask him to join me.
"I can't keep wrecking things, Colin. The way I feel about you has changed, and I don't think it's because there are still some memories of our good times hidden in my head or something."
"Wait.
You for real did that Lateo thing?"
"Yeah. I forgot everything that went down with you."
"Are you fucking with me again?"
"I'm not."
"Seriously. You know Joke had your mind wiped? Don't you feel bad that Nicole has no idea you're with me?"
He doesn't say no, or admit to how little he gives a shit.
"Well, I feel bad," I tell him. "This makes us different. I don't think you suck as a person. I legit believe you'll be better than this one day. But if you want to continue faking out your family, that's your unhappiness, not mine."
Colin shrugs, hiding his pain poorly.
"So what? Forget we ever happened, right?
I don't want you coming at me tomorrow or the day after." He gets up, pacing back and forth, to give me enough time to take back my words. I don't.
"Okay, then. I'm going."
He's holding on to the comic, in no way about to give it back, and crosses the street to retreat back to his safe life built on lies. But then he freezes. He turns and rushes back over to me.
"Are you sure about this?"
I can almost forgive him now.
"I can't screw anyone over anymore, Colin," I say.
"Look,
I loved you,
but now isn't the time for us." Colin flips me off and walks away. I lean forward on the curb to flip through the comic when I realize it's not in my hands. I look around to see if I dropped it before realizing what's happened. Chapter 16. The Girl with the Unfinished Paintings. I forgot what happened with Colin. And I hope to God he'll change, and that it'll be something worth missing. I just hope I remember everything with Genevieve, because she's the one I would have been lucky enough to share a happy ending with. She loves me,
in a way that's not fair to her. And it's shitty times too, because I know the feeling. Before I knock on her door, I ask Eric to wait downstairs for me. I extend an arm to pat his shoulder. He must think I'm trying to hug him, because he leans in and it's awkward, and I recover by hugging him for the first time since we were kids. Thanks again. I feel like you've been my seeing eye dog or something. Forget it. You owe me one now. But don't forget. He slaps his hand over his mouth. Forget I said forget. I'll be downstairs. Okay. I knock on the door, trying to remember everything I have to say while I still have the chance. Her father calls from inside the apartment, asking who it is, and I tell him it's me. He opens the door, studying me up and down. I can smell his beer breath.
How you doing, Aaron?
I'm okay. Is Jen home?
Still in her room, I think.
Other fathers wouldn't let a boy into their home the way he does. Her door is cracked open, and I peek in and see her on her bed surrounded by wet paintbrushes and open paint bottles and sketchbooks. She tears a page out of one book, crumples it up, and throws it onto the floor. The graveyard of failed drawings. Then she grabs a new brush. I knock and let myself in, tensing up when she looks at me. She drops her paintbrush and bursts into tears. I rush to comfort her, but there's no room for me to sit with all these open sketchbooks and unfinished paintings on her bed. There's one of a girl talking to a boy made of leaves, another of an ocean monster destroying a girl's sandcastle, a third of a girl falling out of a tree while a boy sits idly by eating an apple. I shove them aside. I'm not just wrapping my arms around her to make her happy or to lie to myself. I have to stop her hurting. And for once, it's so real, I forget my own forgetting problems. I know better than to ask if you're okay, I whisper. Genevieve pulls her hands away from her face. Now probably isn't the best time to point out the fingerprints of paint across her forehead and cheeks. Seeing you with Colin really messed me up, Aaron. I have no idea if you were at the track field to see Thomas or if it was a coincidence, but it brought back everything I had to pretend never happened. I turn away. I'm sorry about that. And about him. I'm really, really sorry I led you on before the procedure. And even some time after it, I wasn't fully ready to be this guy who liked guys and needed a girlfriend to protect me. She strokes my face, probably getting paint on me. I know. Even after our first kiss, I knew. Only a guy who likes guys wouldn't want to kiss you, I say. I'm sorry for being such an asshole. Genevieve traces my scar, left to right, and right to left, like I have countless times, like she might have too, if I could remember. I could never hate you for being gay, but when you came back to me, I loved forgetting you were. We made a pretty cool faux couple when I thought it was real. I joke. She rests her head on my shoulder. If I could do it over, I wouldn't have lied to myself that it was real. I wouldn't have dated you, and I definitely wouldn't have had sex with you. There's a moment where I think she's going to say something more. She sighs and adds, "So you didn't go through with the procedure. What made you change your mind?" I can't comfortably tell her how Thomas made me okay with myself. I can't tell her how I want to spend my days taking on the world with him, and watching movies, and drinking blue moons late into the night while we draw on each other. The procedure promised happiness, but it wasn't real. About Lateo, actually, my mind is kind of messed up.